Heard of Stephenville?
Well, we're off the beaten path.
You're off the beaten path in Texas. You can be often off the beaten path in Texas.
That's true. We're a ways away from Sydney, anyway.
I'm interested in you for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons I'm interested in you is that you've kept up your athletics. I mean, people like me who used to run quarters and halves and miles and have since put on weight and no longer can run those sort of times look at a guy like you with some kind of envy. You've been a quarter miler, half miler?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah, over many years?
Yeah. Well, as you say, it becomes easy. Around the time I turned about 40 years of age, I entered an intractable midlife crisis.
Yes.
And that was my way of dealing with it.
Okay, you started to run like mad.
Yeah, yeah. And going back to the old athletic pursuits of youth.
And you found the old speed was still there?
Well, it took a while. Probably about 2 or 3 years.
Tendons still stood up to it, and your hamstrings still stood up to it?
Enough to compete on a fairly regular basis.
And your lungs are okay, not full of, and your veins are not full of cholesterol, and your lungs full of old smoke. So here you are, middle-aged, and you're running half miles.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, what's your time for a quarter?
A couple of years ago, I turned in a 54.72.
That is fast. Yeah. 54 at an age of 40-plus. That is fast. And what about a half?
Half mile, a couple of years back, 209. I haven't done quite so well the last couple of years, yeah.
That's pretty good for a half. That's pretty good. Okay, so here you are competing in Masters games in various parts of the world, and you really enjoy that?
I do.
Like our Tom Tressiter, who comes regularly on this program with me. Tom's got now about, 26 gold medalists as a sculler from the World's Masters Series? That's incredible. So here's my guest tonight, who's got a good athletic background. Do anything else that's silly in your life, like going back to playing football when you're 45 or anything like that?
Well, 45 was the last year that I played. Yeah. No, that's the gospel truth.
You mean 1945.
No. I mean 1995. Now, I taught at a college in East Texas for a number of years, and the faculty always fielded a flag football team, American football.
I know, and that's where the poor, wretched faculty end up with crooked knees and crooked back and an arm out of joint, and the students look very, very superior. But you've had a background in academics and working in many colleges. Mm-hmm. Give me a little bit of a rundown on your academic career.
Oh, I think, I've been in and out of academic life. I've done a number of different things, but I've always tended to come back to teaching in one way or another, mainly history, to some degree geography and a few other of the social sciences. My main focus in the last decade or so has been pretty much on British Empire, the Commonwealth, the history of the British people.
Mm. In your curriculum vitae, I noticed you did two Bachelor of Arts degrees,
mm-hmm.
and then you went on, you did your MA, and then you went your PhD, and in all of these, you've got this strong emphasis of British history.
Yeah.
So what's a guy from Stephenville, Texas, doing studying British history? What is Anglophobic about you?
Anglophilic, don't you mean?
You're not fearful of them,
no,
but you're in love with them.
Well, in one sense, I guess there were two things that prompted me to move in that direction. One, I could do the primary research without learning a foreign language well.
Yes, that does help.
Yeah, and secondly, it was driven a bit by my own interest in theology and the dimension of my particular denomination's view of Israel and where Israel could be found in the modern times.
I noticed you did your PhD thesis on one of the most famous trials of earlier this century in France. J'accuse.
Yeah.
Yes.
Neil Zola.
Yes, a tremendous book by Zola, of course, but about Dreyfus trial.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about the British press reaction to the Jewish Dreyfus.
Yeah.
Being accused. It's always been an incredible story, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Of Emile Zola's.
Yeah.
Okay, so you did your PhD. How did the British press react to that?
Oh, I don't know. They were...
What do you mean you don't know? You've just done a PhD in it.
That was 20 years ago. I would say francophobic to some degree.
Fearful of the Jews. Were they also anti-Semitic?
The British weren't, not nearly so much, I think, as probably the French were.
Okay, so you had the big early rising of Zionism in Britain at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they weren't anti-Semitic, but they were anti-French.
Yeah, yeah.
Damn the frogs.
That's right. where did the wogs begin at Calais and all that business?
Yes.
Now, that's a strand in British history that goes back 1,000 years or so.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. And will be seen during the World Cup soccer matches that are being held in France at this moment. Now, you said before that you took a great interest in British history because of your denomination's theology. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, to summarize, and without getting into a lot of in detail or in-depth, scriptural analysis, we believe that the modern-day Israelites are locatable and that they're found among, in essence, the Anglo-American peoples.
So the lost tribes of Israel, according to the various worldwide Churches of God-affiliated bodies,
mm-hmm.
have been found. These are the lost tribes, and they bobbed up in Anglican in England and in Anglo-speaking peoples, particularly the United States.
Yeah, and Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Canada. Wherever you find that.
Smack of a sort of a white supremacist.
Sure it does, and that's one of the weak dimensions of it. I guess the unique thing about our particular approach to this is that inherently the idea that Israel exists today is no more a supremacist notion, a racist notion, than the fact that God chose Abraham to begin working with humanity. Abraham was, as Israel, in the Old Testament, he chose Israel as a nation to work through. But that was by no means where he intended to end. The Israelites happened not to be able to do the job that he called them to do. Well, that is a different issue. We could talk about that, I suppose, for a while. But, there's an interesting parallel, I guess you could say, in the way God, I think, even calls and works with people frequently today. Deuteronomy 7:7 is a critical passage for me. And you're probably well aware that's kind of Moses' parting message to the Israelites. And he brings to their attention, in fact, almost seems to rub their noses in it, God has not called you or chosen you because you're better than other people. In fact, as it says in that scripture, you were the least of people. And it seems that God almost looked in far from focusing on Israel as being somehow genetically or racially or ethnically superior. He seems to like a challenge. Going back to Paul, we talked a bit about Pauline thought before the program began. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26, 7, and 8. And what does it say about how God calls people today? Well, it talks about calling the weak and the foolish. That typically is where he tends to start. In a sense, he can say, if I can work with this group, I can work with anybody in due course, in due time. And
now, other people have done PhDs in the rise of what we might call British Israelite theory, and they would indicate that this is a relatively modern theory, mm-hmm. and that it has been promoted very strongly by people who are good advertising executives like Herbert W. Armstrong.
Yep.
But in point of fact, in more recent decades, has fallen out of favor.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a fair proposition that the whole notion of, as they used to call it, or in some quarters still do, British Israelism, was tied to the rise of the British Empire, and essentially a 19th century phenomenon, and following in its wake the rise of the American people. Even in your own tradition, a Wesleyan tradition, one of the chief spokesmen for the British Israelite movement was John Hardin Allen. That, by the way, you mentioned Herbert Armstrong. That's who Herbert Armstrong drew inspiration from. Probably was one of the very first British Israelites, if you want to call them that, that Herbert Armstrong came into contact with.
But both of us know that during the frontier period of the American civilization and the continent being established, there were lots of weird ideas about this being the new promised land.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
well, that fitted into the ethos and environment of America in the 1800s.
Yeah, very much so.
Mm.
Yeah.
But you don't see it as that.
I see it as God opening the minds of certain people to accomplish certain purposes, different works, different parts of the church have different emphases, and ours, and I suppose this springs out really of an emphasis or a twist or a spin maybe that Herbert Armstrong put on it. The old British Israel theory seemed more to celebrate the accomplishments of the Anglo-American people.
Mm, very triumphalism.
Very much. Well, and it's an in-your-face type of thing. Mm. It's a very short step, as I'm sure you know.
I often wonder what that used to say to Japanese, Chinese, and Indians.
Yeah. Well, it has been employed for racist purposes. Mm-hmm. And that, I would argue, and I think those that come out of my tradition and denomination would argue that that's a misuse. It's not the thing that's wrong, it's the use to which the thing has been put. Again, prophecy, scripture, the New Testament, Paul's writings in Galatians and Romans and so on are very clear. God, he doesn't have a pet people in the sense of...
He made of one blood all the nations on earth to dwell.
Yeah.
Now, my ancestors came from Scotland, and the English pinched a stone from us.
They gave it back to you recently.
Just recently. But for years it sort of stuck under an old wooden chair down there in London. What am I talking about, and what significance has that got?
Well, Jacob's Pillar Stone, and
Hang on. Jacob's Pillar Stone?
Right.
In Scotland?
In Scotland, you bet.
Isn't this just an old myth, a tradition?
Well, I can't answer yes or no. To me, that would not be the heart of what we're dealing with here. To me, the heart of it goes back more to prophecies like you find in Genesis 48 and Genesis 49. I'm not answering the question you ask. I'll come back to that momentarily. But Genesis 48, Genesis 49 is really the framework that to me is the bedrock. And that has to do with, and that's where perhaps you and I might differ in terms of the rules for interpreting scripture, hermeneutics by any other name. Jacob's pillar stone is an interesting sidelight. Now,
you notice that he spoke about the bedrock. Now he comes to the pillar stone, right?
An unintended...
The pillow stone.
The idea among some in the British Israel, those who trumpeted and wrote about that, was that the stone on which Jacob slept, you read about it in Genesis when he was on the moon, that stone was literally carried with him and ultimately by Israel and ultimately by Jeremiah and was transported on a circuitous route, wound up in Ireland, moved to Scotland, and then good old Edward was it the first that came along and stole it away.
But that had a political reason, didn't it?
Well, of course it did.
He just wanted to unite what we call the United Kingdom.
Something like
until
that.
Until the Scots kicked up a fuss and they sent it back there about 20 years ago.
Well, you know, there are people that even would argue that when the Scots stole it in the 50s, I believe, 1955 or somewhere, that what they gave back really wasn't the original stone.
Now, let me just take this up. Because there have been people over the years who have believed, if you go to Glastonbury in England, of course, people believe that who was it?
Joseph of Arimathea.
Joseph of Arimathea, of course. Ended up in Glastonbury. Yeah. And you've got many of these old traditions, along with relics and bits of piggy's bones, as the phrase was used by Chaucer, piggy's bones, referring to the original pieces of the cross and original pieces of saints' bones.
Enough to build every building in Sydney, probably, indeed, when you put it all together.
Now, when you look at that kind of background and that kind of tradition, isn't this triumphalist approach that, you know, the pillow stone of Jacob ended up in Scotland, that the British and American peoples are the lost tribes of Israel restored. Isn't that all part of myth?
Well, let's talk about the historical critical method for a while. If what you are looking for is absolute, irrefutable proof of making this connection between the ancient Israelites who were whisked away in the 8th century by the Assyrian invaders, you're not going to be able to be satisfied.
No. All we've got is poetry. The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and all his cohorts were gleaming with gold.
We've got
lovely poetry, but we don't have historical proof of what happened when they were carried away into slavery.
Yeah, there are there's a 1,200-year gap in what would really satisfy. Now, you know, I straddle two disciplines. I have a degree in theology, some graduate credits in theology, and I have 3 degrees in history. So I know what the historian demands in terms of finding proof. And for us, in our tradition, really, I think what we're dealing with is an article of faith. It's a matter that we're convicted that God has opened our minds to understand certain things in a certain way, and to me that is rather mission-related. And that goes back to where earlier I had talked about Herbert Armstrong adding a dimension to the old British Israelite teachings of for that matter, let's assume for a moment that I'm a crackpot and my ideas are completely off the wall and we're not correct in this. If you look at what's happening in the Anglo-American nations, Okay. Now, coming out of a U.S. background, we had a 13 and 11-year-old boy that took high-powered rifles, enough ammunition to kill everybody in his school, set off a fire alarm, and shot five people dead and wounded quite a few others. Same thing up in Oregon. Now, in Australia, not too many years ago, you had a similar kind of thing. Something's wrong in a society where those kind of problems exist. Something's wrong in a society where the nuclear family is coming apart at the seams. And, we'll pick up a copy of the Sydney Major paper, or, well, maybe not the Stephenville Empire Tribune, which you probably don't get here, but if you look at the headlines, if you listen to the electronic media news presentation, something's causing that. And we would argue that it's a departure from living the way that God would want us to live. And then when you add to that our emphasis that the Anglo-American peoples have a special responsibility before God because of the blessings being given to them in a very special way, then I think that it gives us a sense of purpose in sounding a warning that we may not be punished today, we may not be punished tomorrow, but called into question, ultimately, one day we will be. And in that sense, that gives us an added sense of urgency in terms of placing emphasis where we do.
We wish you well for the rest of your tour. My guest tonight, Dr. Rick Sherrod, a man with some impeccable academic qualifications who's been talking about his interests in history over long periods of time, is a prominent leader of the United Church of God in the United States of America and is now, having successfully lectured here in Sydney these last few days, will be appearing in Canberra and Coffs Harbour, Brisbane, Toowoomba and Melbourne. And you can read about him in academic journals, but also you mentioned the Stephenville Empire Tribune. I do find it difficult to get that paper here in Sydney.